Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, April 23rd, 2020. Producing from his home studio today in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, and I'm working from my home studio, which is north of New York City. We'll continue General Manager Week this week, and former Brewers General Manager Doug Melvin will join us to talk about the Roger Clemens deal he almost pulled off for the Texas Rangers, the pivotal CC Sabathia deal he did make for the Brewers, and what he thought about the record-setting Alex Rodriguez contract back in 2000. But first, we got resolution in the pending Red Sox case. Major League Baseball on Wednesday suspended Red Sox video replay system operator JT Watkins without pay through the 2020 postseason and stripped the team of its second-round draft pick this year after completing an investigation into allegations that the Red Sox stole signs during the 2018 season. Former Red Sox manager Alex Cora, who mutually parted ways with the team in January as part of the fallout from the Astros sign-stealing scandal, is suspended through the 2020 postseason as well, but only for its previous contact as Houston's bench coach, the league indicated as part of its announcement. And the Red Sox announced the interim tag for manager Ron Radecki has been removed. He is the Red Sox manager under contract through the 2020 season. Now, before we get to Kylie McDaniel to talk about that and also to Doug Melvin, today on ESPN Daily, the NFL draft is finally here. But how will it work exactly? With team staff scattered and connecting online, ESPN Daily breaks down the complications and predicts some highly anticipated moves. That's ESPN Daily with Mina Kimes. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Kylie McDaniels covers baseball for ESPN. He writes a lot about prospects, and he's the author of the new book, Future Value, The Battle for Baseball's Soul and How Teams Will Find the Next Superstar. Kylie, how are you holding up?
Doing great, Buster. It's been quite an adjustment, but I'm hanging on.
All right, so we got all this Red Sox news that happened yesterday. My intention with you today was to go in a deep dive on your book. We're going to do the deep dive next week, but generally speaking, and I tried to put myself in your shoes this morning, because it's such an unusual circumstances, I read an interview the other day where they're talking about the number of book sales have gone up dramatically. Not surprisingly, BBC talked about, you know, how online sales, audiobooks, those things are going up. But on the other hand, you as the author, you're locked down. So tell me what your process is now to prepare for the release of your book.
Yeah, it's been a little tricky. I know when all this stuff started happening, Eric and I, panicked a little bit because we're just like, oh, we were planning on going to a lot of high school and college games, setting up book signings around that stuff, maybe doing some, in-person, radio stuff, and we don't get to do that. But I was like, in the balance, like, obviously there's bigger things going on, but people that really want to interact with baseball only have one way to interact with it, which is, reading it, whether it's online or in a book, and that's the two things that we do. So I was like, okay, maybe in the balance, it's actually a little better for sales and people being aware of it to be able to, see it in this way. But yeah, obviously there's bigger things going on, and our lives are, upside down in a way. But yeah, I think it may be like sort of a net positive for the reading experience, I hope.
Again, the name of the book is Future Value, The Battle for Baseball's Soul and How Teams Will Find the Next Superstar. I've read it. It's terrific. We'll go into it more next week. But real quick, what was the inspiration for this? What was the first conversation you and Eric had as you decided to do the book?
So the publisher came to us first, and their sort of pitch was, Eric and I had talked about doing a book, but didn't really have like a concrete idea or timetable or anything. And their pitch was basically, since Moneyball came out, 50 years ago, the book, at the time, scouts thought we were going to get cut back, replaced by numbers and analysts. And then the opposite kind of happened because teams found that especially in amateur baseball and low level minors, the scouting report is the most predictive thing of what a player will be. And now that is now shifting, since the information they have is, exit velo and spin rates and things like that, which are more predictive than, scouting reports. If you kind of want to believe that, there's still some ways to fudge that, which is what we go into depth in the book. And so teams, if they want to cut down scouts and replace them with analysts in the office, which is obviously much cheaper and younger labor and stuff like that, and is a little more conducive to, management consultants and Ivy League MBAs and that sort of thing that's overtaking baseball, they're able to cut back, in those departments. And so they kind of wanted wanted to explore the tension with somebody, I guess two of us, that are sort of plugged into the scouting world, are plugged into the analytics world, and sort of have experienced this stuff firsthand. And so we started diving into that and just realized there were so many different avenues that hadn't been like fully explored. And so we ended up hitting like a lot of stuff, but it's, you know, 80, 90% about sort of like the tension between those two different points of view.
And I have a question for you related to scouting world and the current context coming up in a bit. But first, what did you think of the Red Sox decision?
It was a little bit surprising just because I think the assumption was with this much time of the layoff that there would be more found. But I guess, if, you know, they didn't do as much as the Astros and there's less of a punishment and baseball can just kind of move on. That's probably good for the game. And I think everyone that would have been inclined to do this sort of thing is sufficiently scared. So I think kind of putting it in the rearview mirror and moving on is probably the best thing for everybody. And luckily the Red Sox didn't, you know, do as much as Houston did, so that this becomes like another conversation for 2 or 3 months.
And what I heard was the original Athletic story about the Red Sox stuff came out on January 7th, which was 6 days before the commissioner's office ruled in the Astros thing. What I heard is that the level of cooperation from the players was not nearly the same with the Red Sox as it was with the Astros, because it, and this is me speculating, the Red Sox players probably saw the reaction to the Astros players and, for lack of a better way to describe it, lawyered up and yeah, locked down. And so baseball had a clear idea of exactly what took place with the Houston Astros. I don't think they had as clear information on the Red Sox, but all along what I've been told by sources was, yes, they have something very specific, which was borne out in the final report, but it's not nearly to the level of what the Astros did. And I actually heard from some club executives of other teams yesterday saying, yeah, we probably were doing some similar things, not officially, but we probably had some pitcher who was talking about sequencing and game wandering and, you know, back in the video room, or maybe the video guy was doing that, where the separator for what the Astros did was the real-time mechanism of it.
Yeah, that was actually something that I talked to some people about, and I think I tweeted about it at the time, which was, if every team has a guy sitting there watching the monitor that can essentially do the magic trick of tell people if, you know, somebody wanders in there and say, hey, a fastball's coming, like, can do that. Obviously, I would say at least 25, if not all 30 teams had someone doing that just for like the conversation end of it. And then to think that over the 2 or 3 year period where that would, could have happened, that nobody ever told anyone, hey, when you go up there, you know, look for this or you have this indicator. It's like, I would bet 20 teams have done some version of that, but it could have been as similar, you know, as small as, you know, one or two little conversations that didn't actually impact the game. And then people just put it away. And then obviously the Astros took it to the logical extreme of trying to relay it on a regular basis.
Big picture, do you think we got the full story and what went on, not only with the Red Sox thing, but with the Astros thing? Because I bet the family farm back in Vermont that we don't.
Yeah, and I would bet, like, we, like, I think we've been saying for a while that I'm guessing there were probably a couple other teams that went to the level the Red Sox did, that if, you know, if certain things were revealed, people would be like, yeah, no, we, you know, we also did it. But I think the, I think the intent with MLB's approach was, we want to catch whatever we have to catch. We don't want to catch more than we want to, and we want everyone to have the a strong deterrent to not do this again. And I think that's probably what's happened.
And I'm still shocked that there's not a, an agreement announcement from Major League Baseball coming down and saying, if you do this behavior, you're going to get kicked out of baseball. I think they should have done it back in January, even if they didn't have an agreement, Kylie. I mean, grab the high ground and then let, you know, let the union, if they want to haggle, then that's fine. But I felt like all along, I mean, dating back to 2017, that Rob Manfred needed to seize the high ground. He still hasn't done it.
Yeah, that's you could definitely poke some holes in the leadership of Rob Manfred. And I think sort of handling the scandal sort of area and punishment and taking the high ground, like, you could say Roger Goodell with the NFL has some of the same issues. But yeah, I think there could be some different moves that could have been made in these general areas. And I think if you had to sort of outline what Manfred's strengths are to the owners, it would be money and CBA and those sorts of issues. And I don't think they question him in that area. And because of that, they put up with some of the, you know, sloppier parts of his management.
I felt like that Rob did the fair thing in his handling of Alex Cora, with the suspension running through the 2020 World Series, which was the exact same discipline that AJ Hinch got, which Jeff Luhnow got. And of course, no one could foresee a situation in which we might not have a World Series in 2020, no baseball in 2020, which is why Rob was, you know, it has been criticized for the fact that those suspensions may run out without a game being played or just a handful of games being played. I thought it was the fair thing to do to hold Alex Cora to the same standard. What about you?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And yeah, there is some overlap in like sort of doing the exact same thing and getting the exact same punishment. Obviously, like the optics of the day that it came out yesterday that Cora is suspended for games that may not happen, that he's not employed, is like sort of a weird way for it to go down. But like you're saying, I think it's still the best way to handle it, to try to make it equitable, even if the optics of it are a little silly.
And Luno and Hinch and Cora, they've all been fired or removed from their jobs, however you want to put it. They've all lost money and they've all lost standing. And so it's not as if if there isn't a season or isn't there a bunch of games, it's not as if these guys haven't been penalized in some way.
Yeah, and I think I think the people that are shouting for blood on Twitter are not happy. They would like to see some sort of lifetime ban or, whatever it may be. But yeah, like you're saying, like this stink is going to stay on them for a while. And I don't know when it comes off or how, or if any of them get sort of rehired to the same level they were at, but there's definitely going to be they'll have to run through the gauntlet again to get back in.
Do you think Alex Cora manages again in the big leagues?
I would say he does, but I think it'll be a while.
Interesting. See, first off, yesterday the Red Sox made it official. They took the interim tag off Ron Renneke. I know people in the Red Sox leadership absolutely love Alex. I think if you were to just ask the question of, 30 general managers around baseball, who are the best managers in baseball? Alex would be regarded among the best guys. I wonder if real world stuff that's happening with coronavirus is going to mute that conversation, and people at some point are just going to be ready to go back to, okay, we have baseball back and we're going to try to put the best team on the field and we're going to try to get the best manager possible. And that's how Alex and AJ Hinch wind up back at work.
And I think regardless of how it actually happened, if Alex was, or Carlos Beltran or AJ or Luna or whoever it was sort of spearheading this stuff and is actually sort of the mustache twirling villain that like started all this stuff, the reality is with the coronavirus and with Lunau and maybe Hinch being seen as like the faces of this or the people that spearheaded this or were in charge of this, I think whatever Cora's involvement was, like the narrative of it will not be as harsh as it was to those guys. And I think as, we've seen millions of times in baseball and sports, more generally, if you've got the talent, they'll let you back in. And I think both Hinch and Cora sort of have the talent. And I think Cora is seen, for right or wrong, sort of less culpable than the guys with the Astros. And so, maybe it's 5 or 6 years. Like, I think it'll be a long enough time that it's time to, give this guy a break and give him a second chance. But I think he having the ability and the personal element, all those sorts of things, like it's all going for him. So I just sort of assume somebody will, be able to justify it at some point.
So I thought of this morning and I kind of laughed because it's speculation. It's 100% speculation. And it's absurd, and at the same time, it's not absurd. Tell me if you could not see this sequence of events happening. Alex Rodriguez continues to move forward with his pursuit of the New York Mets. He gets some money people involved. Alex winds up buying the team. And guess who's out there potentially as a manager for him? One of his best friends in the world, Alex Cora, who Alex's brother, Joey Cora, was Alex's double play teammate, who Alex looks up to like a big brother. If that happened, I could see Alex Cora working for Alex Rodriguez someday. Is that completely insane?
No, that makes this is almost like when it's a big moment. There's a guy on first base and you've got a big fat first baseman swinging and you're like, ooh, I could see this guy swinging
right,
too big, hitting a slow grounder to second. I could see this 4-6-3 double play coming in slow motion toward us. And this feels like that instance. I feel like the next time I see one of those headlines that A-Rod is moving forward, like I feel like this is going to be that double play ball where you're like, ooh, this one's lining up just right.
Yeah, exactly. All right. A couple other things. The current situation with the minor leagues, as you understand it, I wanted to get the lay of the land from you on that.
Yeah, the posture all along, and it's been the same way with the international signing and draft when it comes to, I guess, like the little mini CBA that was signed as due to the coronavirus, and then what's going to be happening with the next CBA, what's happening with this PBA, the minor league agreement. Baseball wants there to be to have more control over this general process. They want the draft to be shorter. They want everything to be sort of hard capped and laid out. They want international to have a draft. The expectation from talking to people at MLB and talking to teams and agents is that that will all be in place by 2022. And as part of that, they want there to be fewer minor league teams. And I think the like sort of logical, landing point was for every team to have their four full season affiliates that you can't really touch. And then everything else to just be a complex team, which would be, you know, DSL or the Arizona or Gulf Coast leagues. And that was sort of the report yesterday from multiple sources that they've landed on 120, which for obviously be four organizations per team. And then everything else would be like a non-revenue complex league, which I think is where things were headed because, once you take the teams that, you know, make some money in short season, move them up to A-ball, the A-ball teams that aren't making money kind of, move them out. I think the question, which it sounds like it has been answered a bit or is supposed to be answered in these upcoming negotiations, is minor league baseball wanted to make sure that those contracted cities have some level of baseball. And I think MLB probably wants there for marketing purposes to still be baseball in those cities. And so it sounds like that was the breakthrough is we're okay with moving down to 120 plus the complex leagues if we can keep these stadiums from being like deserted in these cities, you know, in Appalachia or wherever else from having no baseball. And I think that's the part that sort of had some movement. So I would imagine it lands somewhere in that area because when it comes to the draft, international signings in the minor leagues, Major League Baseball just kind of gets what they want.
Kylie, I feel like that minor league baseball completely lost its leverage, any leverage it was trying to generate once the coronavirus hit, because they were obviously with some of the things that they've been doing, they've been trying to drum up support in Congress, and their bigger issues Congress is addressing right now. It felt like that any leverage they may have developed along those lines evaporated. Would you agree with that or no?
Yeah, I think they probably had, I mean, especially like actually when Bernie Sanders was looking at the front runner for the Democratic nomination, as he had weighed in on it and the other, you know, other two candidates had not. And then also, yeah, there's going to be like some sort of reckoning in the business world of if you're sort of small enough and less significant enough, we may be able to let some companies fail, I think is sort of the posture the government's taking. And so since these minor league teams are even with subsidies from big league teams are some of them are still not like viable businesses on their own and losing money every year. And so you can then see that with, you know, bigger fish to fry in other parts of the economy and then sort of the realities. And then also MLB is like a much stronger entity when it comes to negotiating than minor league baseball is. Like you're saying, there was a glimmer of something might be able to be struck or some sort of compromise that could lead to kicking this can down the road a little bit. But like you're saying, I think they just sort of lost whatever leverage they had with all of this stuff happening the last few months.
How are teams preparing for the draft?
It's interesting that in the last couple years, and this is something that's covered in the book a lot, that teams have really been going to a year-round scouting model that they have like full up in. It used to be, I would say 5-10 years ago when I was doing draft prep, some teams like the scouting director didn't know the names of all the projected like sort of first, second round picks. It's like, oh yeah, I heard about that guy. We have some reports. I haven't seen him. Haven't really dove into the data. There isn't much data. And now it's like, you know, you've got for a lot of these major schools, you've got 2 years of TrackMan data on all these guys. You have TrackMan from the Cape. You have like, you know, a model that needs information. And so for the last couple of years, you've been feeding information into it. And I think a lot of teams would be comfortable going 10 rounds. I think it'll still go five, but they would be comfortable going 10 rounds. Even with just, you know, a month of the spring happening. I'm getting texts from a lot of scouts that are basically asking me about players that they haven't seen in person before because they just get a list of players. They get a link to go into a system that has all of their video and they're writing reports just off of the video. And they're like, hey, have you seen this guy before? Like, I'm not quite getting it off of this video. And I go, oh, no, I saw this guy last year against Ole Miss. Look up that game. That's the one that is why, you know, he's rated here for, you know, most other teams in the public rankings and stuff like that. So it's definitely the sort of focus of the evaluation has been shifted more toward data and video and secondhand stuff and only getting one in-person look, maybe two if you saw him in the summer. But teams are definitely comfortable enough to do five rounds. I think it would really be a challenge to try to do 20, which I think will sort of be the status quo going forward. But yeah, for five rounds, I think teams are pretty comfortable with this amount of data because they could have run the draft like with no spring. That's sort of the level of certainty they have even just in the summer, going through all these players.
1 minute left. I had a club official tell me he thinks that when the dust settles, new reality in the scouting world will be much, much different with a lot of scouts having been let go. At the end of this, what's your read?
The sort of rap that I've had talking to people, and nobody's really fought me on this, is if we thought that the reality would be that amateur staff's having 15 or 20 people now, and then eventually having 6 to 8 people, if that was going to be 15 years from now, I think teams involuntarily having a more data-heavy process this year, and just because that there's not as many games, instead of that happening 15 years from now, people think it might be 5 or 6 years from now. Like, that whole process will be sped up because teams that wouldn't have had the stones to like cut their scouting back and really rely on data are now going to be forced to do it. And some of them might like it, both the cost savings and see that the process may not be that much worse. I don't think that's necessarily the right way to look at it. And there's some teams, that I think will continue to have big staffs because they think it's their advantage. But yeah, I think it will speed up whatever is going to happen. And I think their teams are moving more toward what Houston, Milwaukee, Baltimore, these sorts of teams are doing as far as scouting staffing.
A lot of people potentially losing their jobs. All right, Kylie, I will talk to you next week, and we'll dive into your book.
Yep. Thanks for having me on.
Doug Melvin was the longtime general manager of the Texas Rangers and Milwaukee Brewers after years in the front offices of the Yankees and Orioles. He's currently a senior advisor for the Milwaukee Brewers. Doug, how you doing?
Doing great, Buster.
Thanks for joining us and helping to distract us with stories on General Manager Week this week on the podcast. We've had a lot of fun, you know, talking to Pat Gillick and Sandy Alderson and J.P. Ricciardi, and gotten some interesting answers to this question, and I'll lead it off with this. Tell me about the biggest deal that you attempted that didn't come to fruition.
Okay. Well, first off, Buster, you know, when you make these deals like this, you're never totally in control of them, but you always think that you have a chance to make those deals. And my wife always says, how can you remember trades from 1998 or 99, 2000, but you can't remember which day it's garbage or recycled? But I said, that's baseball. We love baseball. It provides everlasting memories. So here we go. And, the one deal that I mentioned was back in Texas. At the end of the 98 season, the Toronto Blue Jays were going to trade Roger Clemens. And I think he had requested a trade at that time. Gord Asher was the general manager, and he just won the Cy Young. And I think Roger was complaining about the Blue Jays not spending money or whatever. So he wanted to get traded. And he had on his list, he had, I think, the Yankees, the Astros, and he sort of controlled that a little bit. But in Texas, we had won in 96, 98. But we lost to the Yankees in the World Series, and we felt we could use one more quality starting pitcher. And Tom Hicks had just currently took over ownership of the club, and he was a Texas alum. So we got involved in trying to get Clemens. And, we thought it would be a big coup for us, with our owner. He was a Texas alum. Roger, we thought he wanted to go to – being from Texas, and we knew he wanted to go to Houston. When Houston sort of backed out of the deal for whatever reasons, I remember them backing out and said they're no longer involved. We thought we had a decent chance, but it was going to be a costly deal for us from a prospect standpoint. But, you know, you're talking about Roger Clemens. But we had offered Ruben Mateo, who, you know, sitting around, people had time. Now, take a look at Ruben Mateo's career. Ruben was our best prospect at the time. And I always tell people, when people ask you the question, who's the best player that you ever had in your years of baseball that didn't quite make it? And my answer is always Ruben Mateo. At age 20, he was in AAA and he had three really good years. And to give you a comparison, he's like Juan Soto of the Washington Nationals now.
Yeah.
To compare him to a modern day player. And that's what Ruben Mateo was. He could really throw. He had an Ellis Valentine, Dave Parker kind of throwing arm. He had big power. He could run. He was just an outstanding player, and he was like a Juan Soto. We had put him in the deal, which was reluctant, but we knew we had to do it, and we had a catcher, Cesar King, and then our first-round draft pick from 95, Jonathan Johnson. And, we were dealing younger players. And Gord Asch, who later was my assistant here in Milwaukee for years, he was very upfront with me and said that he had a deal with another club. If he had a deal with another club, it was for a veteran guy that could really help them too. So, but we had the best young players on the table. And we thought we had a chance. And, of course, it was only my fourth year of GM, and so you're pretty excited. And we had, like I said, won the division in 96 and 98, and we thought we had a chance in 98 season. Rick Helling won 20 games. Aaron Steele won 19. And if we could add Roger Clemens to that, we had added John Wetland. And we had an offense that scored 950 runs every year. And so we did, you know, Juan Gonzalez was the MVP in 98, Pudge in 99. So I wouldn't worry about the offense, but trying to get a quality pitcher, which every year it seems like you're trying to do. But we thought we had a chance, and this was in February. We were headed to spring training, and I remember getting on the plane, and I called Gord. I said, any updates, Gord? And he said, no. He said, I'm just being upfront with you. If the thing falls apart with the veteran guy, then you have the best young players on the table. And so I felt pretty good, and I told Tom Hicks, well, he was all pumped up about it. So I flew to Port Charlotte, Florida, and got off the plane in Florida. We're headed to spring training, and I had a voicemail from Gord. Well, you know, my heart was pumping. I'm thinking we're getting Roger Clemens, and Gord told me. He said, Doug, he said, I'm sorry, I apologize for not, you know, helping you guys out with Clemens, but I'm trading him to the Yankees for David Wells. You know, I couldn't blame Gord Ash for that. Clemens was a Cy Young winner. David Wells was third in the Cy Young that year, and he ended up getting a couple other players. I think Graham Lloyd was one, and Homer Bush, I think, was an infielder. Yep. So I couldn't blame him for making that trade, but boy, I was disappointed. Tom Hicks was, owner, was extremely disappointed, and I would say mad. But that's the way the deals go. And when you're young, you always think, wow, I have a chance to get this guy. And I know later on in my career, 2008, when I thought the same thing, I said, we got a chance to get CC Sabathia. At that point in 2008, I had enough experience. I said, just shut up and keep it to yourself. You know, don't be going around telling other people, because it's an extreme disappointment to come in. But later on, I learned that sometimes you have deals you think you have, and they don't happen, and that would have been a great deal for us to get them. But I understand that Roger Clemens and his agent Alan Hendricks pretty well controlled that. Also, that he really wanted to go to New York first, and Houston, and those were the two top teams. And then I think we were on the list then. But for those look up Ruben Mateo, great prospect that would have been a you know, very good player. He broke his leg later on, jumped on first base, and really fractured his leg and really hurt his career at that point.
Yeah, Doug, it's interesting you said that when you mentioned, you know, because I always assumed that the reason why I was covering the Yankees for the New York Times at the time, and I always assumed that the reason why he wound up going to the Yankees, and it's interesting that Gord, you know, they had that the deal for a veteran pitcher, was because the Yankees at that time, and you remember this because you worked for George Steinbrenner, George would always make side deals with the agents. Like, he'd have stuff around the edge. And I always assumed, and that's what happened in Roger's case, is that the Yankees, David Wells, had a side deal on a contract that, you know, would come down the pike. And I thought that might be difference-making. Do you think that was more so or over the package, or you think it was just, as you say, the agent controlling it?
Well, I think Roger wanted to go to New York, but I think Gord, when you're sitting in Gord Asher's chair and you're trading a Cy Young winner, I think he won back-to-back Cy Youngs, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
The Blue Jays. And you're trading him coming off the year. And the Blue Jays won 80-some games every year, but
they just couldn't get over the hump. The Yankees were a dynasty. But I think in Gord's situation, you're sitting there, it would have been hard to explain getting three young prospects for Roger Clemens when you're still trying to win ball games, still trying to win championships, when you could bring over David Wells. And I think David Wells had two better years for Toronto than Clemens did when he went to New York the next 2 years. But I think that in the end, I think whether the Yankees were trying to get Clemens without giving up David Wells, again, there's always things, Buster, like you said, behind the scenes. Those are big deals that ownership does get involved with.
Those are ownership gets involved in those kind of deals, and they have reason to, because, you know, those are huge deals, they're impact deals, and that. But from Gord's standpoint, I would have probably had to do the David Wells deal too, and he eventually flipped Wells later on to the White Sox, I think a couple years later.
You made reference to the CC Sabathia blockbuster, which, you know, is going to be one of the most memorable trades of all time because of CC and what he did after joining your team. And I remember at the time writing about how you guys were kind of a sleeper in the whole thing because you were, you know, a small market team, not a lot of resources. Whenever a star like a Sabathia becomes available, you know, the reflexes to talk about the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Red Sox and the big market teams. But you guys were on that pretty early, yes?
Yeah. We, you know, again, we had talked to Ron or to Mark Shapiro early, and I indicated to Mark that if we can work a deal out, I would rather work the deal out earlier, and I will give you, you'll make a better deal with me at the start of July than you will at the end of July. I didn't want to get caught up at the end making deals the end of July. A lot of times what happens when you get closer to the deadline, teams are making deals and things are all over the board and there's rumors going on and everything, and then you might not get the player you want, and then you go
make a deal that you really don't want, but you're making a deal just to make a deal. And we liked our ball club at that time, and we never saw a lot of C.C. Sabathia because in the National League, we never really saw him that much. But again, he was coming off the year before. I think he won the Cy Young, and he was like 6-8 with a 3.5 or 3.8 ERA with Cleveland. And that, but we felt again, it was a time to go and get him if we could get him early. Versus a positional player, because you count down the number of starts that he can get. Having an extra 3 or 4 starts in July could make a difference. And in the end, it did make. Between that and him going on 3 days rest, it made a huge difference. We don't win if we don't get him at the first part of July, and we don't win if he goes on pitches with 3 days rest. But I told Mark, so we put in Matt LaPorta, who was our first-round pick. And I said, well, I'll start the deal off with Matt LaPorta right off the bat. And then we went back and forth on players. There was one list of players. Well, Jonathan LaCroix was on that list at the time. And they took a pitcher by the name of Rob Bryson instead of LaCroix off that list. And then we had to come up with be creative, because they went back and forth on Taylor Green or Michael Brantley. And they were both good left-handed hitting prospects. Both had great on-base percentage. Both really good hitters. And if you look, Taylor Green might have had a better year than Brantley did in Double-A.
So we couldn't figure out how to get that deal. I think they weren't sure which player to take or whatever. So I suggested that why don't we have an agreement that if CC comes here and helps us win, I will give you the choice of Taylor Green
or Brantley. That gives you the rest of the summer to look at him.
If CC comes here and we don't win, we don't go to the playoffs,
then we get the choice of picking which player, Brantley or Taylor Green. And if that's going to the playoffs, I was more than happy to let the Indians have that choice.
And they took Michael
Brantley, who turned out to be a very good player, and the best player in that deal for them is LaPorta, played a few years, but Brantley turned out to be the best player.
Yeah, and see, for C.C. Sabathia, you know, at some point I think he will make a speech in Cooperstown and be inducted to the Hall of Fame. And his time with you is such an important part of his legacy because, of course, he was a pending free agent. He wound up getting the biggest contract ever for a starting pitcher, but there was so much talk down the stretch about how he was willing to take the ball on short rest despite all the money that he theoretically had at risk pitching for you. And from your perspective, tell me about watching CC and your conversation with CC down the stretch about all that.
Yeah, well, I always say, you know, talking to Ned Yost and CC, whenever we asked him to go 3 days rest, we made sure to ask him.
And most of the time it was his idea too. He didn't back away from it at all. You know, his performance in September going with 3 days rest was probably, I always said, the most unselfish performance by a professional athlete that I think could ever happen. For a pitcher that's going to go into free agency to go with 3 days rest, I think he did it 4 times at the end. He did it with 3 days rest and did it 4 times. It's very, very unselfish on his part. And, you know, from a Brewer standpoint, we were trying to get the playoffs first time in 25 years, and it was huge for us, and you know, his leadership and doing that down the stretch. We didn't hit in September. We hit like 215 in the month of September, and we didn't hit well, so we needed his pitching and his leadership in that. But he did that. The toughest part was after games. I don't go around the club about much after games, but a few times that I did after games, his agent was standing outside the clubhouse and staring me down, and he was getting phone calls from other agents. What are you doing letting your pitcher go on 3 days rest? He's a free agent. So they're very protective. Their job is to be protective of their player. Our job is to get the most out of every player we can. And
CC stood up and did that. And if he wouldn't have done it, we would have moved on and played our games and had someone else pitch. But when he doesn't back down from doing it, my gosh, you'll say, okay, good, before he changes
his mind or whatever. But it was one of the most unselfish performances from a pro athlete, I think, that I ever experienced in my 20-some years GM.
Yeah, Doug, Brian Peters, his agent who you referenced, told me the story that one time he called you, and then Brian Peters called you to complain about the 3 days rest, or at least, put it on the record, his objection to it. And he said that CC called him shortly after that and basically yelled at him and said, "And you know what? Come down to the hotel. I'm going to buy you breakfast. I'm going to yell at you some more."
I saw Brian Peters this spring training, and we had some laughs about it. He was at our complex in Arizona, and we were talking about it, and I hadn't seen him in a number of years, so we had some good laughs about that at the time. But I know at the time he wasn't laughing, but we did have some good time because it worked out for all of us. We got to the postseason with CC and brought excitement to Milwaukee, and CC went out and got the biggest contract for a left-handed starter. So it worked out well for everybody.
It absolutely did. And as you say, one of the most unselfish thing I've seen in a player in that situation. I completely agree with you. You made reference to Tom Hicks, and you were involved you were general manager of the Rangers when there was a pursuit of Alex Rodriguez. At the time that it was going on, I was, like, wow. It was a surprise, given the level of market. And I'm curious about what you remember about that, because when these deals go down and, fans will critique these type of deals, these massive signings, my response is, that's not a general manager deal. That's an owner deal. But as it was going on, take me through what your thinking was, because obviously, a few years later, they had to sell Alex while eating a lot of the money. As it was going on, what was your thoughts?
Yeah, well, it was interesting that, Alex Rodriguez would be like at the time, it'd be like Mike Trout being a free agent when he was 23 years old, 24 years old or whatever. He was probably one of the top best players in the game. And I went to Tom Hicks, and Tom Hicks was a new owner on the ball club only a couple of years. The winter meetings were in Dallas. That was probably a little dangerous too. And they were in Dallas, the winter meetings at the time. So, Tom had just won with his hockey team, the Dallas Stars, won the Stanley Cup, and he was very excited, and he wanted to bring a star talent to Texas. And Scott Boras was Alex's agent, and Scott, Tom built up a good relationship
at that time. But from my standpoint as a general manager, I'd say, yeah, I would want one of the best players in the game if we can have him. And my only response was that I told Tom Hicks, I said, Tom, you're probably going to have to pay him $20 million a year and probably 5 to 6 years at that time. And because at that time, Manny Ramirez, I think, was making 18. Derek Jeter was going to go to 18. Carlos Delgado was like 17. There was another player in there
that was in the 17, 18 million.
Juan Gonzalez, I think, right? Juan Gonzalez, maybe.
Maybe it was. Well, Juan went to Detroit later. Traded Juan to Detroit. And he had a big offer at 18, somewhere in that range. But that's where the money was on the top players, was in the 17, 18 million dollar category. So being a free, and they weren't free agents. So being a free agent, I said, you're going to have to go $20 million a year for 6 years or so. And that's where I went. And Tom was not afraid of that. And, I had talked about 6 years to 7 years. Scott's talking 10 years, And obviously Scott's thinking more money too. So anyway, the negotiations get to a certain point, and then after that, it is an ownership call, And a lot of these deals, an ownership call. How badly do you want the guy? And you want him to. The other part was that's when they first started getting outs and contracts. And I give Tom credit because I think Scott wanted an out after 3 years. And Tom said, no, I'm not going to pay that kind of money, get my fans that excited about having a good player, and we could lose him in 3 years. And I said, if you're going to do an out, you do it after 5 years at that point, because, I thought having him for 5 years, then, you don't know what's going to happen 5 years. Well, the deal ended up getting into 10 years with a 7-year out. So he ended up, the deal really did turn out, a lot of people think it was 252 at 10, but it turned out to be 7 years, 180 or something, because he did take the out on the deal later on with the Yankees. And then after I had been relieved of my duties with Texas, then I think John Hart came in, and then they worked out a deal with A-Rod to the Yankees at that point. So, but he came in, and he, you know, he had MVP years for us, but we just didn't have enough pitching after winning the division 3 out of 4 years. And then we had a lull there. We knew we were going to have a lull because Juan was going to be a free agent. We weren't they're going to be able to keep him, and Kenny Rogers was gone and whatever. So A-Rod didn't really help the team win at that particular time, even though we still had a few good players, but it didn't help. So, but that's where those deals, some of those deals go, is ownership has an impact in some of them. And again, I don't blame ownership because they're the ones that invest the money into the team and have a part of all this.
Now, the story I'd always heard was that Scott Boras, you know, at that time, the biggest contract in professional sports had been Kevin Garnett with the Timberwolves at $126 million. And then with a late addition to the offer, Scott got Alex's deal to exactly twice what Kevin Garnett got at 252. When you heard the final numbers, I'm just curious, based on, you know, where you thought they might go and where they wound up, what was your sort of reaction?
Well, I remember walking, we had a GM's meeting that next morning in the hotel in Dallas at the winter meetings, and I got stared down by 29 other general managers as I walked into that room. And that is like, what the hell are we doing? You know, because everybody's concerned about where that's going to take their star players to the next level whenever these kind of big contracts are done. So it wasn't a popular deal amongst other general managers and teams. But now you look at where the salaries have gone into baseball. They've always gone up. There hasn't been many years where they've always gone the other way. But no, it was reaction. Obviously, the Texas fans were very excited about it. And I think when a big player like that, like Alex Rodriguez, or any big free agent, they're always, the first reaction is always, it's going to be New York, Chicago, LA. It's going to be the large market teams. And I think that's where I think there's a lot of people unrested. How did Texas get involved in a player like that, or certain smaller markets get involved with the biggest free agent out there? Because that's usually doesn't happen. And it wasn't the Texas Rangers style previously under ownership with Tom Schieffer and Rusty Rose and George Bush and that. But Tom Hicks came in and he felt good about it. Like I said, coming off a Stanley Cup with the hockey team, he wanted to have the big, he had the Mike Modano at that time was the star player with the Stars, and he wanted the best player in baseball, and he ended up getting him.
Last one for you. I was curious. I mentioned you were with the Baltimore Orioles. A favorite story you like to tell people about Cal Ripken?
Well, the one thing I talk about Cal Ripken, and it's funny, I'm reading John Eisenberg's book right now with The Streak, Cal Ripken and Lou Gehrig, and you probably maybe read it or know of it, Buster.
Yep.
And I'm reading that book now, and it's interesting. I was there with the Orioles from 86 to 94. And Cal just was all baseball. And, you know, you don't have a lot of conversations with him, but when you have a conversation, you know, it's usually serious baseball. But, and he loved playing basketball. But the one conversation, the one thing that I like to tell about Cal Ripken is when I was a farm director there in Baltimore, I used to go down to, and after we had the draft, we'd go to Bluefield, where Cal Ripken started. And I used to go and tell talk to the team and talk to the players. And I said, okay, this would be about 4 weeks in, and see how many guys have hit a home run here. How many guys have hit a home run here in Bluefield? And, you know, 7 or 8 of the guys would put their hands up. And I said, you accomplished something that Cal Ripken never did. Cal never hit a home run in Bluefield. He hit 8 doubles the whole year. He hit about 240, 250 or something in Bluefield. So I was trying to pump the kids up that you did something that Cal Ripken never did. But beyond Cal Ripken's streak of playing games, the thing that I admired the most, and I used to tell everybody else, this was the old school days when we took infield. And I said, what I admired beyond playing the games every day, he never missed taking infield. Wow. He never missed taking an infield. He would grab his glove and say, come on, let's go and take infield. Now, you know, he was influenced by his dad, who would make sure he would stare you down, making sure you're getting your work in today. But I always admired that, and I always used to say that, because there was a point where a veteran guy would say, hey, somebody else go take it. And you'd see a catcher at first base taking infield, or an outfielder going out and playing third base to take. But when Cal Ripken grabbed his glove and said we had infield, that's when you used to have infield practice. There wasn't anybody that wasn't going to go out there and not take their regular infield practice. And that's the thing that admired me as much, because, you know, everybody wants to play the game. But does everybody want to take infield? No, but Cal Ripken took infield every day. And I always use that story as a farm director, telling our managers, coaches, and that. And then they used to have one that was funny as hell when Cal Ripken Sr., they used to have an invisible infield. And I don't know if you've ever seen them do that.
Yeah,
where the infielders are all out there, sort of like the Max Patkin sort of. And Cal Sr., who wasn't much of a jokester, would go out there, pretend he's hitting the ball. And if you're sitting there watching infield and you're a fan, you'd say, where's the ball? And the hitting ball to third base, he'd field, you know, Leo Gomez would pretend he's fielding the ball and a ground ball. And Cal would backhand it, come up and throw to first. And everybody's looking for the ball. One of the funniest things, but Cal Sr. would even do that at time. But no, Cal not missing infield practice was one of the things that I admired the most. And now we don't take infield, but just his work ethic and the way he went about it, game days. We had a young kid here in Milwaukee for years was that way. Prince Fielder. I think he only missed like 8 games in 6 years for us. But Prince was that way on game day. Boy, he would stare people down if they weren't in the lineup and that. But he played every day, and I gave him a lot of credit. But no, Cal was – there was a reason why Cal was a Hall of Fame player, because his first year, he struggled in the minor leagues after being drafted. And they weren't sure that he was a pitcher or an infielder. There were some people arguing that he should have been a pitcher, and he dominated as a pitcher in high school. But he wanted to be a positional player first. And he played mostly all third base in the minor leagues until Earl Weaver said he's going to be my shortstop, and he went out and played shortstop all those years.
Exactly. Well, when you have your best player posting up like that, it certainly makes it a lot easier for the manager. All right, Doug. Well, I appreciate the storytelling and helping to distract us.
Okay, Buster. Thanks. Always enjoy it. I got to go
take out the garbage now.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Thursday. First up, Andrew Campbell at Real Camp Drew writes in, going forward, why don't teams just continue to use replay to cheat? Major League Baseball is making it pretty obvious that they don't consider cheating very egregious given the recent punishments doled out to the last 2 of the 3 World Series champs. What do you think about that, Buster?
Well, I'd say this. I mean, if you're Alex Cora, if you're AJ Hinch, you're Jeff Luhnow, you have paid a price. Now, maybe it may not be as big a price as what some people want, but you've been fired, you lost your salary for this year, and you've been absolutely dragged through it in baseball. I do think, and I've been saying it for weeks and months, that Rob needs to come out and just put down a dictate that if you engage in this sort of contact, you're going to get kicked out of baseball. And just put it down and let everybody know that going forward. I mean, that's effectively where they wound up in terms of suspensions they rendered. I just think they need to formalize it and make it clear to everybody and then post those rules on the clubhouse doors like they do with the gambling rules.
CrossFit School of Sweat writes in regards to Alex Cora, I think a more appropriate suspension, considering the circumstances, would be a 1-year suspension effective from whenever the startup date is to resume play. 2020 isn't going to happen, so what he received is meaningless. Do you agree with that?
No, school. I as I've said to Kylie, as I just mentioned, I do think, I mean, I'm curious, Taylor, about your perspective. It's not like these guys haven't been hammered to some degree. Like they have been penalized to a very large degree.
Yeah, I think losing the cash is the biggest thing for these guys. I mean, I think sitting out a year, you know, whatever, they're going to get another job. But I think losing that paycheck, I mean, that hurts everyone, and it applies to major league managers and executives.
Exactly.
Real quick question for you, springing it on you here. I know I am, and it's not baseball related, I am juiced up for the NFL draft, mostly because it is sports related, it's live, it's going to be the only game in town for a while. How much is Buster Olney going to watch of it tonight?
100%. My Minnesota Vikings have two first-round picks. We need a wide receiver. We traded Stephon Diggs. We are ready to go.
Nice. I'm excited. I didn't know you were a Vikings guy. That's interesting.
Huge. Yeah, that's why I'm bitter and angry at the world, because I waited my whole life for a Super Bowl title.
All righty. That does it for Bleacher Tweets.
That's it for today. My thanks to Kylie, to Taylor, to Doug Melvin. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great day and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.